Hello, welcome to this great podcast, Law and Guidance. I've got a fantastic guest here who is not a lawyer. Regular listeners will know that there have only been, I think, three or four campaigners, if you like, who are not lawyers, who've had an impact on the law or who are raising issues about the law. And so you'll remember Gina Miller as one of my guests, not a lawyer. Baroness Tanny Gray Thompson, not a lawyer. Helen Pankhurst, CBE, the great-great-granddaughter of Emmeline Pankhurst, the suffragist. And of course, more recently, Maxine Peake. And so it's with no surprise and no pressure at all that I've got a woman who many of you will know from her campaigning and indeed the author of the book Pregnant Then Screwed, The Truth About Motherhood Penalty and How to Fix It. And that person this week on this podcast is Jolie Brearley. Hello, Jolie.
Hello. I mean, obviously your most eminent podcast guest after that list. So Jolie Brearley from you.
Well, you are. You're brilliant. And there's so much to talk about. So I need to crack on because I think you're due on the BBC, then LBC, and then everything ending in, you know, C, insofar as radio and television is concerned, but talking about the important work that you're doing. So I wonder if I can ask you to just give us a brief introduction of who are you? I've said that, you know, you're the founder and CEO of Pregnant Then Screwed. But what is it and how did that come about?
When I was 4 months pregnant with my first child, I informed my employer that I was pregnant. And the next day they sacked me by voicemail. And my employer was a children's charity. So that experience obviously was a complete shocker. Not only had I been sacked, I then felt I'd be unable to get another job because I was 4 months pregnant. So I was showing. Yeah. I tried to do something about it. I called a number of helplines, but didn't feel I got the help that I needed. Ended up getting a solicitor to support me. They wrote the charity a letter to demand I be compensated. The charity just threw that letter in the bin. That process cost me £250. And when you've no idea where your next paycheck is coming from, hemorrhaging that type of money is terrifying. And then the lawyer said to me, okay, look, your next stage would be to take them to court. I said, how much is that going to cost me? They said, well, it's a pretty complicated case. So it could be, you know, about £9,000.
That's a wage, isn't it, in some sectors?
I mean, it's who on earth? I don't know anybody that has £9,000 just sloshing around in their bank account for a rainy day. Certainly, I didn't. And I was about to have a baby and I had no income. So I said, okay, I'll think about it. And the next day I went for a routine hospital appointment, was told I was having a high-risk pregnancy. My cervix had almost vanished. And they said, look, your baby is hanging on by a thread. And if you go into labor now, the baby will die. So they rushed me into surgery to do this delightful process where they tried to bolt my cervix together to keep the baby in place. And after surgery, they said, look, this may not work. It's about a 25% success rate. And so what you've got to do is reduce any stress in your life because it's stress that will trigger early onset labor. And if the baby comes now, the baby will die. And as you only have 3 months, less one day to raise a tribunal claim from the point the discrimination occurs, I couldn't wait until I'd had my baby. He's fine. He's a very healthy 7-year-old, thankfully. And then pick the case up at a later date. So I was forced to drop it. I was literally given the choice between the health of my unborn child or the justice that I deserved. And so I found myself pregnant, unemployed, unable to access justice, thinking my baby was going to die, lying on a sofa, watching daytime telly, thinking, what on earth has just happened? And I'm now completely powerless. I have nothing. I have no income. I have no job. My identity was so connected to my job. Partner had to pay my way, had to keep a roof over my head and food on my table, and all I was useful for was as a vessel for this growing fetus, and I wasn't even doing that very well. And that process, that those 3 weeks in, essentially radicalized me, and they made me see the world in a very different way. And I became a fierce feminist, and a year and a half later, it was still eating away at me. And so I set Pregnant Then Screwed Up as a place for women to tell their stories anonymously. That's how it started. And here we are 6 years later.
Wow. Well, it is a campaign, I guess, because you've now got sort of, have you got some staff as well? You've got 10,000 followers on Twitter, on LinkedIn. You've written a book. You're on Instagram. And really, you are giving a voice to the voiceless, you know. And I practice in employment law, so I know precisely what you're talking about here when we're talking about, you know, sex discrimination and protected characteristics. But did you ever envisage it to be what it's become? I just noticed that in addition to your Northern Power Women award, you've just won an award. I think last night I saw, I'd finished a case and I went on LinkedIn and saw you holding a trophy. What was that for? Last Saturday, I was like, wow, another award.
All these, I'm going to need a cabinet.
Yeah.
It was the Sheila McKenzie Award for Campaigner of the Year, 2021, that one. Wow. I mean, in answer to your question, yeah, I never in a million years expected to end up here. And I think that's part of the beauty of it. It was very grassroots. It really, when it started, I genuinely wanted to expose these stories, and I wanted to connect with other women that had had a similar experience to me, because that was cathartic. And then all these women got in touch and started telling their stories, and then it just sort of mushroomed, and the media became interested. And as soon as we did our first TV interview, then these stories just started flooding in. And I guess I thought when I first started it that once we expose these stories, I call it my waiting for a hero moment. I expected somebody to come in on a horse and go, oh, now we can see that this problem. Oh, well, we'll fix it. We just didn't know it was there.
Yes.
And of course, that was very naive. And I realized there was nobody on a horse coming to save the day. And so then that's when the campaigning started. And we started really banging down Parliament's doors to say, what are you doing? Why are you not fixing this problem?
Yes. Now, you had a recent case, didn't you? And I just want you, I know all about it, but it's better when things come from the horse's mouth, if you like, which was taking the government to court. And it was about the discriminatory nature of some of the COVID provisions. Because what's alerted from the Fawcett Society, who've been doing some surveys, and indeed you've been doing some research, which I'll come to, is that women have been disproportionately affected, for example, by COVID and the COVID provisions. But what was the legal case about that you took the government to court over? It's a brave thing to do, to be, you know, a young mum feminist, and next you're bringing a case against the state.
Well, I love that you call me a young mum. Actually, I just, you know, had a bit of a run. The reason why we took the government's court was because we were so sick and tired of every policy, every bit of guidance that the government put forward. There was this baby blind spot. They completely forgot about pregnant women and mothers every single time. And we would alert them to it, and we would be shouting and saying, hold on, you've forgotten pregnant women and mothers again. And sometimes they would rectify it. And in this time they didn't, and they announced the self-employed income support scheme. And the way that worked was to take your average earnings over the last 3 years and give you 80% of those earnings. If you take maternity leave in the last 3 years, your payment would be reduced by about a third, probably a little bit more. If you'd taken two maternity leaves in the last 3 years, it would be at least two-thirds. So we were speaking to women whose payment they were getting was just, I mean, it was barely worth the paper it was written on, all because they had given birth to a baby and they'd done the most important job in the world, which is caring for that child. And it was not fair when you compare it to men and you compare it to childless women. Why should women be doubly punished for having a baby and for looking after it? I mean, maternity leave pay is appalling. It's £151 a week. You can't live on it. It's the third lowest pay in Europe. So to try and survive maternity leave on that terrible pay and then be punished again was just so excruciating. And we were livid. And we genuinely thought at first they'll rectify this. They've just, again, forgotten about pregnant women. But we had various MPs bring this up in Parliament, and Ellie Reeves, who's a brilliant Labour MP, brought it up with Rishi Sunak in the House of Parliament. And Rishi's response was, everybody has ups and downs in earnings. It could be because of sick leave, sabbaticals, or other, meaning maternity leave is the same as going on holiday or being unwell. And I mean, that was a red rag to a bull for us. How dare you? How dare you reduce the role of what women do to going on holiday? So we wrote them the pre-action protocol letter. They confirmed that statement in their response. And then we thought, right, we're going to court. And we did. And
wow.
But sadly, we lost.
Yes. So how do you feel about that? I mean, and I suppose, could you see that that was going to be a loss in the sense that we're going through a pandemic? I'm playing devil's advocate here, you know, and appreciate that I am a barrister. But, you know, we're going through a pandemic. The government is trying to deal with all sorts of different aspects of the life and indeed the economy and manage it. And so, could you see that actually maternity leave and women's rights, if you like, might have been seen as sort of further down the food chain? Or did you think actually this is a decent government who understands the point and might well take it up?
So I appreciated that we were absolutely in an emergency and they had to get this scheme out quickly because there were hundreds of thousands of self-employed people who then didn't have an income. So they needed to move as fast as they could. And during the court case, they made a very good case for why making that scheme equal could have meant that it was open to various problems. You know, people could have used the scheme when they weren't self-employed. There were all sorts of challenges they would have had to have overcome. However, the government has a legal responsibility to assess all of its schemes to make sure they are equal to all types. And they clearly had not done that with this scheme. And so to me, it was as if they were just riding roughshod over the Equality Act. And of course, yes, I appreciate that we were in emergency, but they could have backtracked it at a later date. They could have said, okay, we've realised we've made this error and done something about it, but they didn't. They just continued to say, no, it's fine. There's nothing to see here. There's no problem. So there were sort of two claims, as it were, with that court case. And I had... given it a 50-50 whether we would fail on the first claim, which is about whether it was reasonable to put that scheme into place because we were in an emergency. And so we failed as in the judge ruled that it was reasonable for them to have done it. And yeah. So, you know, as we've discussed, I can sort of understand that, but I couldn't understand why we failed on the second because I did feel it was completely in breach of the Equality Act. And the judge's point essentially, I mean, obviously there's pages and pages and pages.
Oh, yeah, I've read it.
Essentially was that everybody was could equally access that scheme, which of course they could, but that wasn't the point. And that's not what equality is about. Of course, everybody can equally access it. It doesn't mean that the way the scheme had been set up is equal. So it's an equity versus equality argument to me. Yeah. So now we're appealing it. And because we hope that there'll be a judge that really understands equality law and gets what we're saying. And I'm not sure we'll succeed on whether it was reasonable for them to have put that scheme in place, but we really want them to overturn the second ruling. That's why we're appealing.
Well, I think it's right to test that, isn't it? You know, and often people bring cases, not always to win as we would like to, but it's important to test the legislation, which I think you're very, very right in doing. Now, Jodie, throughout the pandemic, the last 12 months, lots of things have happened. But one of the things that have happened is that I've spent a lot of time advising women and minorities to the extent that I then wrote a book about basic employment rights. It's very, very basics in lay terms. And one of the other things that's happened is the women have gone backwards. And the other thing that's happened is that you also wrote a book. So that's three things of significance. So I want to start by asking how your book came about and what it's about. And then I want to ask you about what's happened in the pandemic, really, to women, because we know the women have taken the brunt of the homeschooling generally, aside from the pregnant aspect, and how you see that correcting itself. So firstly, how did your book come about?
A book agent contacted me about 4 years ago and said, I think you can write a book. And I said, don't be ridiculous. And then she pestered me until I said, oh, for God's sake, okay, I'll sign your contract. And then 2 years later, I finally got going and started writing it. And essentially, it's the culmination of everything that I've learned and everything Pregnant and Screwed is about. So it's about the motherhood penalty. And the motherhood penalty is the fact that mothers receive less pay, they're judged as more incompetent and more distracted compared to their childless counterparts. And it's all because of this bias, this implicit bias we have towards women from the point that they say they're pregnant.
Yeah.
And because of pregnancy and maternity discrimination, and because all of our structures and all of our systems are still set up to favour the unencumbered worker, and there's still being somebody at home doing the childcare, and inevitably, that's women.
Yes, yes. Oh, you know, it's amazing. Now, we are, I don't want to spoil it for people, but we have a book club at Women in the Law UK. Once a month, we invite the author and we read your book. And we discuss the book and ask you about the book. So I hope you'll come back. I think are you November? I can't quite remember the schedule. I've been too busy working. So if you haven't read the book yet, or if you have read it, but you'd like to ask Jolie some questions about it, please come on. And I need to confirm that Jolie's available, because I know how busy you are now with Pregnant and Then Screwed. Jolie, the other question I was asking was about the effect of the pandemic on women. And it's been horrendous for all of us. For women who it hasn't affected, you know, good for you and well done. But for the majority, it's meant that actually some women have resigned from the workplace. Mm-hmm. They've lost their sources of employment and income, and of course, single parent families where there are women. So all sorts have happened. And so have you seen that as well? And from the pregnancy side, what has been the impact of the pandemic? Because of course, pregnant women can't even receive the vaccine. That's one of the issues.
They can now, but they're having problems with accessing it.
Right.
But there's been so many problems, and that lots of them could have been avoided. And obviously the most apparent problem is the fact that in the early stages of the pandemic, you know, two or three times during lockdown, the kids were at home, mm-hmm. whether it was school or childcare. And it's women that hoover up all of that additional work. So PricewaterhouseCoopers said that when the schools were closed, that added 31 hours of extra work a week onto a woman's schedule. That is literally another full-time job. And it is not possible to do paid work and then to add 31 hours of extra work onto your week without it impacting your paid work. And so women were begging to be furloughed. Sadly, 71% of them in the second lockdown were turned down when they asked to be furloughed, or they were trying to reduce their hours, or they were just calling in sick, or they were just burning themselves out completely. Yeah. And it meant that the standard of their work started to deteriorate. Now, lots of companies have made redundancies and are continuing to make redundancies. And although this is illegal, we know from research that the key criteria they're using when they're making redundancies is the standard of that person's work. And of course, the standard of women's work has inevitably deteriorated because they've been doing all of this additional unpaid work. So we are seeing mothers in particular losing their jobs at a rate of knots. I mean, it's terrifying how many women are falling out of the workforce. And actually, overall, more men have left the workforce than women. But when you break the data down by age, that age between 25 to 34, it's frightening how many women have lost their jobs. And 60% more women of that age range have lost their jobs, certainly towards the end of 2020, than men aged between 34 to 40. So that's the age when women have young kids, of course.
Wow.
And we're also seeing, you know, if you compare it to 2008 and the economic crash, the number of women who've lost their jobs, it's 78%, I think. A lot of our work has been about women calling us saying, I'm being pushed out of my job and I think it's because I'm pregnant and I think it's because of my caring responsibilities. Our research in July with 20,000 mothers found that 15% of mothers say they either had been made redundant or expected to be. And just over half said the reason they're being made redundant is because of childcare issues. So they know why they're being pushed out. And that's illegal. It's completely illegal. But it's so hard to prove, as I'm sure you know. And as we know, fewer than 1% of women who experience discrimination even raise a tribunal claim.
Yes.
But they're not, they feel unable to use the justice service for a variety of reasons. So we're seeing a generational rollback in maternal employment. That's pretty much inevitable. And that is really bad for the economy. It's really bad for families. It's really bad for child poverty. And obviously it's really bad for gender equality. So that's the first thing. And we saw our advice lines received. We've had a 450% increase in the number of calls over the last year.
Wow.
And so the key calls we've had have been redundancy. And the second one has been health and safety, pregnant women at work. So when the pandemic was first announced, but when lockdown was, on the cards, and the government on the 16th of March put pregnant women into the vulnerable category.
Yes, they did.
They never said what that meant. They didn't explain what that meant for pregnant women who have jobs and were going out to work. So we were dealing with frantic pregnant women calling us saying, what does that mean? Does that mean I should go to work tomorrow? Does that mean I should get on the tube? Does that mean, like, what does that mean for me? And we didn't know at first. And we unpicked it all. And so we had, a clear response for pregnant women about what they should and they shouldn't do. But we were researching it all the way through what is actually happening on the ground. And what we found was that in the first lockdown, lots of pregnant women were suspended from work because they'd been put in the vulnerable category, but the majority were suspended on the wrong terms. So it was no pay, they were told to take holiday, they were suspended on sick pay. And that was more likely to happen if you were Black, Asian, or ethnic minority. You were more likely to be suspended on the wrong terms. But also we found that a very high number of pregnant women were having direct contact with patients who could have COVID-19 either in care homes or in hospitals. And again, it was higher for Black, Asian, or ethnic minority women. They were more likely to be placed in dangerous situations working directly with patients who could have COVID-19. So we were really worried, and nobody was doing anything about this. The government just sort of washed their hands of it. It felt like it took 9 months before they issued specific guidance for pregnant women in the workplace. 9 months! You could have had a baby in that time. And so we were really worried, and we were doing everything we could to raise awareness of it. And then in April 2020, Mary Adjiapong, 21-year-old nurse, tragically lost her life. And I still struggle to talk about it now, but it broke us. Like, it really, really did break us, because Mary is emblematic of everything that went wrong to me. A Black pregnant woman in the prime of her life, who spent her entire career caring for others and making sure they were okay, lost her life because nobody was protecting her and looking after her. And it was horrible. When now, thankfully, we work with her husband, Ernest, who's a wonderful, incredible human being. And he works with us on a campaign to continue to try and keep pregnant women safe.
And she was only 30. We're both feeling quite emotional, because I remember the night that was on the news, because of course we were all serially watching, weren't we, every night, to just keep up with the figures and the regulations and what was happening. Mm-hmm. And the photographs of her in a graduation dress and just all awful, that one did think, crikey, this is awful, and there is no protection. Mm-hmm. And so I could, when you said it broke you, I really concur with that. I can just feel it, and just to think about her, because the baby did survive though.
Yeah, the daughter Mary, they've named her
Oh,
Mary.
the name of Mary. Oh.
But she had a 2-year-old as well, 2-year-old son. And I mean, yeah, I Ernest told me that the son still asks when she's coming home, and he can't, he's, well, he certainly, when we last talked about it, said he still couldn't bring himself to tell him what had happened. He just would keep saying, "Oh, mummy's at work." Oh, I mean, yeah.
Gosh, I know. So, well, perhaps it's a good time to just ask you about well-being. Some of these cases are, I know I'll put my hand up, and thousands of people listen to this podcast, so they will have heard that we can all, I say all the time, we can all do better for our well-being. But I work long hours, have 3 children, probably drink too much Prosecco when I can, not walk enough. Not walk the dog enough. So I wonder where you're dealing with quite a highly emotive situation. It's very different to, being a barrister, isn't it? You're dealing directly with those who are affected and are calling up, and you're already getting emotional about Mary's case. How do you keep grounded? What do you do for your own well-being, just to just look after yourself whilst campaigning on this important issue?
To be honest, Sally, I'm probably not the best person to ask because I haven't learned how to deal with it at all. And when everything first started happening, I just stopped sleeping. I stopped sleeping. I was working constantly and I burnt myself out and I burnt my colleague out. And I just couldn't stop. And I think in part it was because I said to myself, and this is obviously true, I'm incredibly lucky, I'm incredibly privileged. I have 2 healthy children. I have a job that is paying me a wage. I have a partner who has an income. I live in a house with a garden. I'm safe at home. I'm white. I'm privileged. I need to do something positive for the people that aren't in as lucky a position as I am. And all of that is obviously true. But at the same time, I think because I kept saying that to myself, I didn't stop and I didn't look after me. And I did burn myself out. And, in probably May, it wasn't actually, I mean, Mary really knocked me for six, and it took me a while to pull myself together again after that. But I did have moments where I'd just cry, for hours and not know what was wrong with me. And yeah, I mean, you've got to, you have to, you absolutely have to look after yourself. And I've got a bit better. I exercise, try and do a bit of exercise every day, and that really helps. Or take a walk. And I don't look at any screens after 8 p.m. I have that rule now. So no screens at all after 8 p.m. And that really helps as well. So it's little things, I think, make a really big difference. But you've got to sleep, haven't you? If you're not sleeping, which is
Oh,
what
gosh,
made me
yes.
sleeping, and it was just, a perpetual problem. And so I had to get my sleep back on track. And that meant, having a bath, doing exercise, not looking at screens after 8 p.m., all that really, really helped.
Absolutely, absolutely. Jolie, you're not a qualified lawyer, but I kind of feel like you've become a lawyer by virtue of, knowing the Equality Act, looking at the COVID regulations as they became, and all this law that you've been reading for so long to bring challenges, if you like, looking at discriminatory legislation. But you're a campaigner. Do you wish you were a lawyer?
No.
And
Oh, I missed the end of that, Sally. It went funny. Can you say it again?
I'll repeat it. I was saying you're not a lawyer, but you actually know an awful lot of the Equality Act, inside out, I would think, and you know a lot about discriminatory legislation. And so, but you're a campaigner, and I wondered, one, if you wish you were a lawyer, and two, barrister or solicitor, what advice you'd give to a young person wanting to get into the law?
That's an interesting question. I have learned along the way lots of information about the Equality Act and employment law that has been incredibly useful with the work that we've been doing. And I have a very good friend called Danielle Ayres, who's a legal partner at Gorvin's. And she, I met with her at the beginning of Pregnant Then Scrooge. We met up in Manchester after accidentally meeting on Mumsnet. It's a long story. I'm not a usual contributor to Mumsnet, but we accidentally met on Mumsnet. We went for a cup of tea and I asked her if she'd help me set up a free legal advice line for Pregnant Then Scrooge. Right, she said yes, and I couldn't quite believe it. I thought she'd had too many coffees, and she's still going. We've still with her. She's brilliant.
So, she was at Gorvin's. She's still at Gorvin's. I've not spoken to her for a while.
Yeah, she's still at Gorvin's. Yeah, she's just an absolute joy to work with. She's really funny, and she cares. You know, she genuinely cares. But she has a tough job, and I don't envy her at all. So I'm not sure I would want to be an employment lawyer, because I like what I do in that it touches on lots of different aspects. I quite like, you know, I get bored quite easily, and not that it's not boring being an employment lawyer, but I like to do writing, and I like to talk to Parliament, and I like to support women who've got problems. I'm enjoying the spread of what I do. Yes. And in terms of advice, for somebody who wants to get into employment law, I mean, I would say, you know, got to get experience, haven't you? You need to not only be, you know, trying to work within an employment law firm, but working. We have advice lines that people contact, and the diversity of requests and questions that we get is fascinating. And so having a broad understanding, not just of your area of law, but all the many challenges that people are genuinely really experiencing on the ground, is, I would say, really important to be a really good lawyer.
Yes, absolutely. Well, in different sectors as well, isn't it? Different specialisms too. That experience is crucial. So Jodie, what would you say, or what advice would you give for a woman of childbearing age? You know, what should they really know? I gave a seminar earlier this week, as I record, and I was saying it's important for people to enjoy maternity leave, but if work is your hobby, then you will feel like you've lost your identity when you're on maternity leave, because all you have is to care for a child. Mm-hmm. But that is a job in itself, and we need the opportunity to do that job well. So the idea of, you know, discriminatory practices that stops people being employed by virtue of being pregnant is just abhorrent to me, but it still happens. So what would you say in terms of rights? So I often say to my mentees who are of a certain age and are thinking about families, you know, about how long, you know, they want to be a partner, but equally they want to have a baby. And so we spend a lot of time talking about maternity rights, accrued rights, blah, 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 timing and so on and so forth. So what advice would you give to a childbearing woman, particularly about knowing their rights?
Well, I would say read up, get to know your rights, because if you face discrimination in the workplace, if you know your rights, it's so powerful. And as soon as you feel that the environment's changing and your employer is behaving differently towards you, or they're doing something that kind of straddles discrimination law, if you make it very clear that you know your rights and that they better not screw with you, the likelihood is they'll stop. And we see that time and time again. When people call our advice lines and they tell us what's going on and we give them the information that they need and they use that information, they will come back and say, oh, it's all okay, they've stopped doing it, or they've reinstated my job, or they've given me that pay rise that they said they would. And I think, I mean, it doesn't always work, of course, but in the majority of cases it does. And I think employers just think that they can get away with that sort of behaviour. But, you know, as soon as you make it clear that they can't, then things change. So get to know your rights. If you feel that you're facing discrimination, document absolutely everything. Try and have a conversation with your employer, if you feel that you can do, about what you're experiencing, about how you feel. Because as well as showing that you know your rights and that making them often back off, sometimes employers, I think, feel really awkward if you say you're pregnant. They don't really know how to deal with it. And that awkwardness can lead them to do things like alienate you from meetings or give you lower personal development reviews that they would have done otherwise. So if you try and have a really open dialogue with them about how you're feeling, then again, that can make a positive difference, but document everything. And if it continues, contact us and we can talk you through what your rights are, and also contact ACAS. That's always my advice on discrimination. But more broadly, I would say if you're of childbearing age and you want to protect your career, there's so many different things to think about. You know, childcare, we have the second most expensive childcare system in the world. So what are you going to do about childcare? Can you afford it? And will you have family that can perhaps support you? Does it mean that you'll need to work fewer hours for your employer? If so, what kind of flexible working policies do they have in place? And also think about shared parental leave. If you are with a partner and you're both eligible for shared parental leave, then use it. Because that's the biggest protector of your career is, you know, we know from research that the more time dads take out to care for their children, the higher women's salaries are overall. They do better in their careers overall. So think about using shared parental leave as well.
Fantastic. I was just going to come to shared parental leave. And my question really is about the uptake. The uptake is better, but it's been so poor for ages. It was like 1.4 or something ridiculous. Now it's gone up to 3, I think, when I last checked. Why do you think that the uptake here in the UK is not great? And because I see it changing now after we've had this period at home with COVID lockdown, you know, more men will, you know, have enjoyed their time at home with the children, getting a little bit more involved. And so I see perhaps that it will change in the uptake in a work-life balance. But I just wondered what your thoughts were on why the uptake has been so dismal.
I mean, shared parental leave is a completely failed system set up by the coalition government. It's most couples are not eligible for it. So you're not eligible for it if you earn below a certain threshold. You're not eligible for it if you're self-employed. Don't quote me on this, but I think it's around only 25% of couples are actually even eligible for shared parental leave before you then move into the fact that it's not shared parental leave, it's shared maternity leave. It requires a woman to give away a portion of her maternity to her partner for it to work. And also the finances don't stack up, partly because often the man in the relationship will earn the most money. So him reducing his income to £151 a week has a negative impact on the whole family's finances. But also in most companies, if they offer enhanced maternity pay, they very rarely also offer enhanced paternity.
Yeah.
So again, women and, you know, sort of by the very nature of the system, it's them that take the time out to care for their children. And we know, because other countries have shown us repeatedly, the only way you make paternity leave work is by ring fencing it and properly paying it. So if you look at all the countries that have done that, Sweden did it in the 70s. So we have enough data to know that it works. Then you see men take time out to care for their children in their droves. And we know that men want to. They really want to care for their kids. They really want to spend more time with them. 85% of dads said they'd do anything to spend more time with their children. So this isn't about men not wanting to care for their children. Yeah. Failed system. And what the government did, rather than fix the system, was spent millions of pounds on promoting a failed system.
I know, I saw it was all over the underground, everywhere.
Millions they spent, which is literally the definition of polishing a turd. I mean, it makes no sense. Just fix the system so that it works for families.
There is another issue there, which is that I represent a lot of men who, when they go to ask for the paternity leave, are often met with this response, are you not taking your career seriously? And because there was a thought, wasn't there, that the men just didn't want to care for their children, which is nonsense. But a lot of men do. And so there is an issue and a work to do with the workplace culture, which responds to a man saying, well, actually, I'd like to, you know, take advantage of the shared parental. Firstly, they go and ask for the policy. And then, you know, people struggle to find it and then understand it. Then they find it and then they're met from the employer saying, oh, not taking your career seriously. And they say, well, yeah, I am. I just want to take advantage of this.
Yeah, men are much more likely to face discrimination if they ask for flexible working or shared parental leave compared to women. In fact, men are much more likely to have a flexible working request rejected compared to women. And that's all because of these deeply entrenched gender stereotypes, which tell us it should be the woman at home caring for her kids. And so, of course, if a dad asks for it, then he's seen as not committed to his job. Whereas for women, it's sort of, you know, more expected. But that's creating lots of the problems we see with gender equality, because it's not encouraged by employees. And it's because most companies are ran by old white men who have, that's the way things were when they were younger. You know, this is all very new to them. And so, I mean, I do think things will progress and get better because that old guard.
Yes. Yeah.
New guard will come in, and parents of my generation and the next generation seem much more keen on proper equality in the home, or certainly striving towards better equality in the home. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we've had some terrible stories for men. You know, there was a man who told us that he was on shared parental leave and his boss used to email him and start the email, "Hello, nanny." And there was a guy who told me he'd requested shared parental leave and his boss said, "Shall I get you a dress while you're at it?" You know, they're just these ridiculous comments. And it's so complicated. The shared parental leave system is so complicated.
Yeah.
Most people can't figure it out. I mean, I tried to cover it in the book and even by the end of it, my brain was boggled. It's so necessarily complicated that most people give up when they try. Yeah. HR departments don't understand it, so they can't help.
I know. Well, Jolie, that's my dog squealing at the doors, and I know you've got to go. I'd like to just ask you about, you know, I'm a barrister and I work with a lot of solicitors, and I just wonder, how can lawyers help, and what's next for you and the campaign? How can lawyers help in your work, really, whether as advisors or helplines? I know you've got the brilliant Danielle, but what can we do to help in this area that you're brilliantly campaigning in?
So for people who are lawyers and human beings, the things that you can do to help, I always say, are firstly, I mean, read the book.
Yes.
Talk about this with friends and family as much as you can, because you'd be surprised how many people have swallowed the patriarchal pill and don't, you know, have some really weird and wonderful ways of looking at things. So it's always good to have these conversations as much as possible with other people. You know, donate to campaigns like ours, and support. When we're campaigning, we often ask people to write to their MP, so get to know your MP and talk to them about the key issues that we really care about, which are childcare, paternity leave, flexible working. Those are our top three. And access to justice is also incredibly important. So we're always running campaigns about this, and we ask people to contact their MPs and get to know your MP. Hopefully you'll have an MP who doesn't have a completely different worldview like I do. And I mean, and I always say, if you have boys, talk to them about being a dad, talk to them about what their hopes are for being a father. We don't have conversations with boys like that. And model gender equality in the home for your children. Make sure you're sharing the domestic load at home, because if they see it, your kids see it, they're more likely to implement it when they get older. In terms of lawyers, our advice line is, we have a triage service at the moment. So the first people that you will speak to are HR, people that are trained in HR to CIPD level 7 or above. And then if you need an employment lawyer, it's passed on to Danielle and her team to deal with. We are looking at ways of expanding. And so we will be announcing more ways that people can get involved very soon, but I can't tell you at the moment.
Come on. Do you know, somebody said to me the other day, I think it was Felicity Garrick, UC, saying, "You get people to spill all sorts on your podcast." And I was saying, "Oh." She said, "Didn't you get, she named a whole load of people. She was like, did you get Cherie Blast? I don't think so. And then she was naming various people. So I have clearly failed at getting you to spill the next stage of the future of Pregnant Then Screwed. But I'm delighted to hear it. And just to conclude then, where do you see the campaign going then in the next few years? What's next? I know you can't disclose cases and so on and so forth. I know a bit about some of them, but where do you see the campaign and you going with it? As what's next, really?
I mean, obviously the pandemic isn't over yet. There's still a
Yeah.
lot of work to do. And the furlough scheme hasn't finished. And I expect that in September, perhaps even earlier, we will see lots of women, pregnant women and mothers being forced out of their job when that furlough scheme comes to a close. So we're preparing for that at the moment. There are also still lots of problems that we're constantly dealing with around the vaccine. So there have been issues with pregnant women and the vaccine, them being able to access it. But also, we feel very strongly that pregnant women should be prioritized for the vaccine because they are more vulnerable.
Yeah.
So we're really heavily campaigning on that at the moment. Once we feel like things are getting back to normal, whatever normal means, what we really want to do is utilize the pure anger and emotion that we have seen over the last year. Because women are livid, mothers are furious. And the last thing we want to do is just move on and forget the last year happened. Because that anger is an engine that we need in order to ignite change. And so we will be doing, we're looking at all sorts of different ways that we can bring everybody together and harness that anger to create positive change and to get politicians to listen to what it is we now need.
That is so powerful. I can't tell you. Jolie, you've been absolutely awesome. Thank you for
Thank
coming
you.
to talk about the law and guidance and policy, I suppose. If people want to follow you, just remind me of your Twitter handle. I think they can just follow you by typing your name. But what's your Twitter handle?
It's pregnant screwed.
Yes, there's no then in it, is it? I knew there was a slight caveat. Brilliant. Jolie, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. I really, really appreciate it.